I recently gave a school career talk in my capacity as a STEM ambassador.
Remind us what a STEM ambassador is.
STEM ambassadors are professionals in science, technology, engineering, and maths professions who use some of their time to inspire the next generation of kids and students to go into STEM careers.
What sort of age group is this aimed at?
It's aimed at anyone school age to sort of university age. In this particular case, I was talking to a group of year 10s who were 14 and 15, I think that's right, yes, who were studying computer science GCSE.
So they'd already chosen, so the chances are that they might do a career that's somewhat adjunct computing in some way.
Yes, possibly. I mean, you know, it's GCSE, so you know, this might be one of 10 subjects they're studying at the moment, but the idea of this is to give them a nudge into carrying that on at least the next stage of further education or looking at apprenticeships and so on, and giving them a chance to find out what's involved in actually doing a job in software development, and giving them a chance to ask questions about how I got there.
So what was the setting and how many students were you talking to?
This was in their school, in their computing classroom, which was mightily impressive compared to the kind of places I learned about computers when I was their age, because we just had ICT lessons. We didn't have actual computing lessons. So they had all actual computing stuff on the walls rather than just here's how a spreadsheet works, which I thought was quite nice to see. But yeah, I was literally just went into their classroom in one of their lessons and stood at the front and gave a short presentation about me and how I got to where I am, and then did a sort of Q&A session with them for the rest of the lesson, lasted about 45 minutes.
How engaged were they as a group, or were there like a small number of people asking questions and the rest of them staring out the window?
I mean, I think mostly they were at least politely paying attention.
Facing front, at least.
There were probably about half a dozen who asked the majority of the questions, but probably about a dozen overall out of a group of about 20 to 30 who asked questions. So there was a fair amount of engagement. It certainly wasn't just, yeah, me talking at them the whole time, which was quite good because I've never done one of these before. And especially I've never done stuff with this age group before. So it was difficult to know exactly how to pitch things.
What sort of questions did you get?
The ones that I wasn't expecting were things like, what spec is your computer? Like, they're very interested in that, and like, oh, does the company buy it for you, or do you have to buy it yourself? One of them asked if that's a tax deductible expense, which
wow,
which is a bit of a left field question. So I gave him a brief primer on the difference between being self-employed and working for a company. But I think one of the most interesting questions I got, which I've reflected on a bit, was they asked about, because my company, I'd explained that my company is mostly remote and my team is all in different places around the UK. They asked if I preferred working in an office or working remotely, to which I answered, I prefer working remotely. But reflecting on it and thinking about sort of career journey, I think I'd discuss a bit more about how it's probably better when you're starting out, when you're a junior developer. There's a lot of advantage to being there in person and paradoxically being there with the more experienced people.
Yeah, that's going to be tricky if all of you are wanting to stay at
exactly,
home.
Exactly, yeah. I prefer being at home, but yeah. But yeah, so I thought that was an interesting question. Other than that, it was, yeah, various things about what subjects I took and what sort of projects I like to work on and things like that.
And being asked about the projects that you're working on, was there an appreciation of like open source and working on open source?
There wasn't as such, but one of the questions I got asked, so the teacher like fielded questions ahead of time and sent them to me. So one of the ones that I got asked ahead of time was whether I collaborated with other people and other companies on work, which gave me the opportunity to say, well, yes, because I work on an open source project, so a lot of the work I do is collaborative. Mm-hmm. And sort of gave them a bit of a primer on what open source was and why I thought that was a good way of doing things.
That's a whole separate talk on its own, isn't it?
That's a whole separate thing. This was like literally a 2-minute, this is what open source means and here's how I've done it kind of thing. But yeah, I did actually have the opportunity to do that, which was quite good.
Did you mention the fact that you do a podcast in your spare time?
Yeah, we got 20 to 30 new subscribers.
No, I didn't. I didn't quite squeeze that bit in the time, unfortunately. Maybe I'll try and do it as a sort of, yeah, also about me kind of thing.
Would you do it again?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's tricky finding the sort of right combination of people looking for stuff and stuff that I'm able to do. So there's a website for when you're signed up as a STEM ambassador where teachers basically say, I've got this activity going on, I'm looking for people to come in. But it's finding those things which are within range of me and also match up with what I can do. But I, having done this once now and got sort of a bit of a feel for what it's like, I would definitely be up for doing it again. Yeah. And if people are interested in becoming a STEM ambassador and doing this sort of thing as well, if you go to stem.org.uk, you can find out all about it there.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, how do you become an ambassador? Is there a ceremony or something?
It's not quite that. Basically, you get a criminal records check and you get to say you're okay to go and talk to kids.
Do you do a DBS check as well?
Yes,
right,
exactly.
Okay, cool.
That's what it's called now.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And so once you're registered as an ambassador, it's up to you then to find the events and things that you want to participate in.
Exactly. You can either put an offer up and say, here's the things I can do, or you can find people asking and say, you know, I can do this, and they can pick. So I've spoken about some other things I've done, which were more sort of widely organized events about like competitions and mentoring schemes, which where they say, you know, anyone who has the time to do this can sign up and you all sort of join in. Whereas some like in-person events tend to be, you know, we're looking for one or two people on this day who can come, and then you'll offer yourself up. And if it matches, you can do that.
Linux Matters is part of the Late Night Linux family. If you enjoy this show, then please consider supporting us and the rest of the Late Night Linux team using the PayPal or Patreon links you can find at linuxmatters.sh/support. For $5 a month on Patreon, you can enjoy an ad-free feed of our show. Or for $10, get access to all the Late Night Linux shows ad-free. We love to get your feedback via email, show@linuxmatters.sh, or you can chat with us and other listeners in our Telegram group. All the details are available at linuxmatters.sh/contact.
I am helping organise a bar camp in Surrey.
What is a bar camp?
I'm so glad you asked. I actually only found out the origin of the name quite recently, and the reason I looked at what the name was because when you start going around asking people for use of a venue for a bar camp, especially educational establishments like schools and colleges, they want to know what you mean by bar camp. And like, well, are we having camping here? Is there going to be a bar? And it's like, no, neither of those things, which is really confusing. So as I understand it, the term bar camp originates from, there was a type of conference that they wanted to organize, and there was already one called Foo Camp. And so they created their alternate one was called Bar Camp, as in Foo, Bar, Baz. That's why it's called Bar Camp.
I think Foo Camp was an invite-only event, and they wanted to make a public one, wasn't it? Something like that.
Yeah, it was something like that. Anyway, doesn't really matter. It's an unconference. That means the schedule is not set ahead of time. So you don't have a schedule with a list of speakers on a website. You just register your interest in attendance, get a ticket, turn up if that's appropriate, and you decide what you want to talk about, if you want to talk about something. And at an unconference, everyone is encouraged to talk about something, and it doesn't have to be about technology. I recently went to one in London Bar Camp, and I sat in on a talk about Mozilla Firefox. I also sat in on a talk about AI music creation, and from the non-technical side, I was in a talk on making zines, and the focus was with as few tools as possible. So getting a piece of paper and folding it in a particular way that you can write on it, fold it up, and then use that as a means to start a revolution or something. And it's good. But my point being, there were creative tasks and creative sessions and discussion sessions, and it wasn't just people talking at you with slides, but there was some of that as well.
Right.
So that's really what an unconference is. It is a conference that doesn't have a fixed schedule ahead of time. The people who turn up are the people who make the event happen with whatever they want to talk about. And so I came away from the one in London quite excited and fired up, and I really enjoyed it. So well done to the organizers. And I was chatting to my friend Laura Tchaikovsky, who is a dev rel for a company called Dragonfly DB. And I chat to her quite a lot. She lives in Godalming, which is not too far away in Surrey. And she said, I'd really like to do a bar camp in Surrey. And I said, yes, that would be a great idea. And then she just went off and created a planning document, and we have a regular catch up, and she found a venue. And so we're going to do it. And I'll put a link in the show notes to all the details, but I can tell you a little bit more about the process. But it's very early on. We like registered a domain and fixed a date, and we've set up a site where we can, you can register and get your ticket. And that's it so far. We haven't got sponsors, and there's loads of other things we haven't done yet. But it's far away enough in the year that we can get all that done in time.
So when is it happening?
So we're doing it on the first weekend in August, the 2nd of August. It's on the Saturday. It's only a one-day conference, and it runs from 9 a.m. to 5:30. And it's going to be at Godalming College. And this is very easy for everyone to get to. Everyone who lives near Godalming, it's very easy to get to. It's easy to get to by car. There's a huge car park. And if you're coming by train, the train station isn't too far to walk. So it's not too bad to get to. We've got a couple of buildings. They've opened up the ground floor, and we've got some classrooms. So they're decent sized rooms. They've got projectors. There's tables and chairs. And we've also got the sports hall as well. So we've got quite a bit of space for as many sessions as we want to run, spread over two different buildings that are right next to each other. And all the classrooms are on the ground floor. And so it's all super accessible. So, people in wheelchairs or with restricted movement should be okay to get in, because we've selected only ground floor rooms, and there's bathrooms and accessible bathrooms and all that kind of stuff. So we were pretty keen on this venue, and they were very kind to let us go over and have a look around. And they're really lovely, and we're quite happy once we explain there's nothing to do with camping and nothing to do with bars.
And you just explained that you're in a couple of buildings and the rooms and what have you. Have you got some appreciation for like how many people you can accommodate?
That's interesting. The sports hall is enormous. So quite a lot of people will fit in a sports hall for like the communal space. Like if we wanted to have a couple of exhibitors, we could probably put them in there. And there's some corridor space outside. Each room maxes out probably 20 to 30 people, something like that. Probably 20, 30 would be a bit of a push. And we've got two rooms in one of the buildings, and then we've got two in the building next door. And it's only a short walk from one building to the other. You could do it in a few seconds. It's not like they're on opposite sides of the site or anything. They're right next to each other. But we have the option of more rooms if we think we're going to have more people. And we've got a target of how many people we think might come to an event like that. We're not looking for hundreds and hundreds of people. We're looking for, a couple of hundred would be a lot, I think. So probably less than that. But somewhere between 100 and 200 would probably be a good amount of people. And if there were lots of people who wanted to give talks and four rooms wasn't enough, we can ask them to unlock additional rooms that are just opposite the rooms we've already got. So it's not like we have to open another building or anything like that. It should be pretty straightforward.
Are you organizing this like cold, just going into it full of enthusiasm, or have you got some sort of mentor who's been giving you some advice and guidance?
Well, I'll be honest, Laura is doing most of the work here. She has tons of experience doing this kind of stuff. She's very good at this kind of stuff. She's been doing it for years. She's really good at doing event organizing, and she knows exactly what's needed. But we had a call with Terence Eden, who organized the London Bar Camp, and we asked him to brain dump in our direction. So we took loads of notes, and we've been to enough things like Odd Camp, and I had fresh memories from the London one. So I knew some of the things that they did that worked. And so we're going to borrow some of those things. But Bar Camp, it's only one day. It's not like we've got to worry about accommodation for people. We're going to try and get sponsors, try and figure out what we do about refreshments if we can. maybe have a
bar,
a van. So no, definitely no bar, no camping. Maybe have an area. If the weather's nice, then maybe people can sit out on the grass because there is a big field next to the sports hall, and maybe people can, you know, bring a blanket and sit out on the grass at lunchtime or something like that. We're trying to figure all those details out, but it's basically the key message about any bar camp, really. They're all somewhat similar, a similar theme. And the idea is really to get people who are passionate about something to talk about and share their knowledge about that topic. Some of it could be technology. It doesn't have to be, though. And we can learn from each other in a friendly, accessible setting with other like-minded, friendly people. That's really the goal, is to have an accessible, friendly, respectful environment in which people can share whatever it is they're passionate about.
And should people still come if they're not up for talking about something themselves? If
just want to go and listen? Yeah. Like, you know, if you think about how many hours there are in a day, like we're going to run from 9 till 5:30, and there's going to be a slot for lunch and a couple of slots for breaks. So there's a limited number of slots we're going to have in each day, in the day. And there's a limited number of rooms. And so even if we had 200 people, they couldn't all do a talk. So naturally, there are going to be some people who are going to gravitate towards wanting to give a talk, and also plenty of people who won't. And that's fine. That's all part of it. We would encourage people who are interested and have something that they think is interesting and other people might want to know to give a talk. Like, I did not think at London Bar Camp that I would sit in a talk and learn about how revolutions are started with homemade magazines, but I did. You know, I didn't think I'd learn about all new features that are happening in Mozilla Firefox that actually got me actually excited about Mozilla Firefox future releases, which I did not think was going to happen either. And there were other things like games to play and other fun things. So there was, I like the diversity of topics that you get at bar camps, and that's why we wanted to organize one that was outside London, near us, that we can find a decent venue that is accessible. That was important. And like I said, it's got a big car park. It's even got some EV charging points for those of us who care about that kind of thing. And if people want to come on a bike, they can probably cycle, get a train. Godalming's not, you know, the middle of nowhere. It's a fairly accessible place to get to. So you'll probably hear more about this at some point, but the key thing to put in your diary is the 2nd of August. And we'll put a note in the show notes that links to how you can get a ticket. So you can already get a ticket if you want to. And we will talk more about this in a future episode, no doubt.
This episode is sponsored by Tailscale, but get your finger away from that skip button. I'm going to explain how I use the free Tailscale personal plan to host global LAN parties and why you, fellow Linux enthusiasts, should check it out. Tailscale effortlessly provides the benefits of WireGuard without the hassle of manually configuring it. My office in town is seamlessly connected to our home LAN using Tailscale subnet routing, which is just a tick box configuration. It made it simple to set up SyncThing for offsite backups without exposing them to the public internet. I instantly switch between work and home tailnets to connect to the resources I need, and I even share a tailnet with friends in other countries to create a LAN to play old games that only offer multiplay over local networks. Loads of the Late Night Linux family hosts are using Tailscale to make complex configurations easier than melting butter with a lightsaber. And you could too, because the Tailscale personal plan will always be free. To support the show and become a networking Jedi, try Tailscale for free today. You'll get up to 100 devices and 3 users for free with no credit card required at tailscale.com/linuxmatters. That's tailscale.com/linuxmatters. Having successfully got Alan and Mark using Powerline Go, it's time for the bait and switch, as I tell you, I've moved to Starship.
Oh, God. I can't keep up, man.
What's Starship, then?
Starship is, and I quote, the minimal, blazing fast, and infinitely customizable prompt for any shell. So we talked about Powerline a couple of times. I think because, Mark, you did some customizations to that to tell you what version of Moodle was in the project that you were currently looking at.
Yeah.
I think that came about because I was talking about glyphs and nerd fonts, mm-hmm. and you'd said, oh, it's interesting that you've seen these fancy prompts, but you didn't know how people made them work.
Yeah.
I'd started using Powerline some years ago because predominantly it looked nice. And the problem with Powerline Go for me in recent times is that it doesn't look as nice as I want it to. And I couldn't find any way to theme it. And having spent a great deal of time adding Capuchin gorgeousness to everything in my system, I had this rather ugly Powerline prompt.
I think you're pushing it a little bit too. It's not ugly. It might not fit your theme, but I think
functional.
It is a command line prompt that only its mother can love, I'm sure.
Well, once the thought had entered my head, I'm going to change from Powerline, I noticed a couple of things about Powerline that I really hadn't spotted before. And that's, it's quite big. Like, it's got lots of words and things. And I know you can tune it and tweak it to change the maximum lengths of things, but it does seem to take up quite a lot of space.
You mean all that information it's giving you?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
When you just change it to a C:\ or something like that.
Well, yeah, you can, but I do like lots of information in the prompt. It is a productivity tool. You know, you can glance down, you can see the status of your Git tree that you're in, and it's very helpful. And I was aware that Starship is apparently the new hotness for shell prompts. And I've looked at it in the past, but bounced off it because all of the demos that you tend to see for Starship favor sort of the prompt being on one line, or rather the status information being on one line, and then a carriage return to get to the actual prompt where you type. And I really don't like that. I don't know if it's because I'm old and curmudgeonly, but I like my prompt and my text entry to move together as one, not be a multi-line thing.
If you're a member of single line curmudgeon club, then I'm joining you because I cannot stand two line prompts. I think they're insane.
Yeah.
And anyone else who's listening who wants to join us in single line curmudgeon club, come to our Telegram channel and we'll give you the private handshake and everything.
So a lot of people use Starship because it has a lot of information that it can display. And that's why you see these sort of dual line prompts, because they pack in a load of information. Anyway, I sat down with a pen and a pencil and I looked at all of the configuration capabilities that were in Starship. And my goal was to display more information than I was currently seeing in Powerline, but in less space that Powerline took up. And most importantly, to make it fit with my Capuchin theme.
Vitally important, yes.
That's the key motivation. Let's be absolutely clear. So having decided that's what I was going to do, the first thing I did is I invited my daughter in, who's very disciplined on the order of colours, to be rainbow ordered. And I showed her the Capuchin colour scheme. And I said, which of these should I use and in what order should they appear along the prompt? So she's helped make a beautiful rainbow prompt for me. And once I'd got that down, I started putting together my status information. And this is a visual thing, so I'll have in the show notes a link that you can go to with a little animation of how it all works so you can see visually. But there were some things that I thought, I don't need to see some of these things. So I've gone for sort of a visual representation of most things. So instead of my username, I have a little green ninja, which is me. And when I'm root, instead of the word root, it's a little red demon. So I use nerd font glyphs to denote who the user is. And if unexpectedly I'm not logged in as either of those accounts, then it does show the full text username. So green ninja is me and red demon is root. And then similarly for the path prompt, instead of doing the full path, Powerline enables you to do substitutions. So all of the common directories that you have, like home, instead of the word home or tilde, is actually a little house. And if you have like /documents, for example, I have a document glyph. So it's home icon /a document icon. So you can contract a lot of the common directories down to three little pictures rather than a whole bunch of words. And so I've gone through and deeply customized sort of the visual presentation of all of this. And I'm particularly happy with like how Git trees are presented, because I've used all of the glyphs that are available in Nerd Fonts to show how far forward, behind you are with your different branches and what have you. And it all does this in just a few glyph characters. And if at any point you're confused as to what these little glyphs mean, you can just type Starship Explain and it will break down the font. It will display the prompt character by character vertically, and it will then annotate what each of the elements of the prompt are, so you can remind yourself.
Yes, so you don't have to have all of this translation stored in your brain.
Right. It's easy for me because I designed it.
So you were kind enough to show this to me in the office, and you shared the configuration with me, which I put on my computer. In fact, I put on every single computer. I have now followed the Ninja Master and removed Powerline Go from everything, literally everything. And now I've got Starship on there, and I've used your config. And I've just realized that when I open a terminal, I do see my name, because my name is not Martin.
Correct.
I didn't look at the config. Is there a substitution in there that basically says if name is Martin, yeah, then show a ninja?
Oh. Yeah. So all you need to do is just grep that file for my name and change it to Alan, and you too can be a ninja.
I will do that across all my new machines, yes.
So the thing that I'm interested in is the same thing I was interested in with Powerline Go, which is it extensible? Can you easily write your own little widgets, and do you have to contribute them to the code base or build them into the code base for them to work, or can you plug them in separately?
Yes and yes. So there is one of the modules in Starship, I think, is called Project, and that already knows the context of the directory you're in. So it uses some heuristics, and if it's like a node project, it knows how to look at packages.json and things like that, and it will put the version of the project in the prompt for you, for example. So a whole bunch of people have obviously contributed things like that for popular project frameworks. Now, if you're using Moodle, and I did check because I anticipated this question, which is not one of those supported frameworks, they've got another module which is called Custom.
Ah.
And you can add the Custom module, and then you can create your own little bit of scripting or something to go and look at whatever it is you want to do, mm-hmm, and then display that in your prompt. So I think for your use case, you'll be able to create a Moodle one as a custom thing just for you. Or if you were so inclined, you could add Moodle to the projects, mm-hmm, thing upstream, and then everyone would benefit.
Nice.
At work, I was sharing my screen and someone saw my terminal after you shared your Starship config with me. And they were like, oh, you're using Starship? And I said, yes. And they went, oh, can you share your config? And I was like, well, okay, you'll get it from here. And I pointed to your config and they got it. And then someone else at work asked me about my shell prompt, and I shared it with them, and they said something like, I cannot be bothered to figure out how to do this. Just tell me exactly what command to type. And I was like, okay, no worries. I got you, man. And so your Starship config is now on multiple computers in Anchor. So well done.
Well, that's nice to hear. And I've had friends that have seen my screen go, ooh, I like that. So it has spread far and wide, and I've put it in a GitHub gist, which will be in the show notes. So if you want to go and grab it, you can do that too. Baked into it is the palette for the Capuchin color theme. So if you like the design but you don't like the colors, you can take it and you can just go in there and change the hex color scheme and make it for your, you know, your own theme that you want to use. But Starship is great. It's infinitely customizable, and you can rejoin a single line curmudgeonly club just as you want to. So I've been very happy with it. And yeah, come and give it a try. Let me know what you think.